Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You know, a big reason that so many people oppose the individual mandate in President Obama's health reform law is that they just don't think government should tell us what to buy, that that's not what's supposed to happen in a free country. But what if you have no free will? What if even your choice to support or oppose the mandate is not really your own? Dr. Sam Harris is here, skeptic and neuroscientist, best known for his book, The End of Faith, which argues against religious belief, and his book, The Moral Landscape, which says human morality can be understood and developed best in terms of science, not religion. Sam Harris's new book is Free Will, which he argues is an illusion. Dr. Harris, thanks very much for doing this, and welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me back, Brian.
Before we discuss free will, yes or no, that's a pretty abstract proposition for a lot of people, so I want to ask you why it matters. I think I'm deciding what to say right now. I think I'm deciding what to eat for dinner tonight or what candidate to vote for come election day. I experience that as free will either way. Why does it matter to people's everyday lives if it's actually an illusion?
Well, it matters because there are certain moral illusions that arise as a result. People feel that other people are the ultimate cause of their actions in ways that dictate certain policies and lead in many situations to failures of compassion and increased callousness that I think really does damage to our society. So a few examples. First of all, we should acknowledge that a belief in free will explicitly informs our criminal justice system. That the Supreme Court has said that it's dependent on free will, and that a deterministic view of the universe, which is in fact essentially the view that science gives us, is incompatible with our notion of criminal justice. The issue is the moment you look closely at the causes of human action, and we begin to understand them more and more clearly at the level of the brain, it begins to seem exculpatory in a way. So for instance, when we find a murderer has committed a murder, but when upon scanning his brain, we find that he has a brain tumor in the relevant area that would explain his violent impulses, well, that's completely exculpatory. We then look at him as someone who's just a victim of bad biology. And if we could have prevented his brain tumor, we should have. If we could cure his brain tumor, that would be the compassionate and right thing to do. And anyone who would argue that we should keep him stuck with a brain tumor as a punishment for his crimes makes no sense, because that's the tumor is, in fact, the cause of his crimes. But people imagine that a normal brain, i.e. a brain without a brain tumor, of a psychopath or a criminal, is a very different story. And what I argue in this book is that it actually isn't a different story. A complete understanding of the neurophysiology of any murderer's brain would be analogous to finding a tumor in it, in that it would give us a sense that there's no place to really place the blame, because we would now see the wrong genes being relentlessly transcribed. We would see how the microstructure of his brain had been dictated by causes and events over which he had no conscious knowledge or control. And that's a moral and legal problem, which I try to sort out in this book.
And in fact, you begin the book with the story of a horrible, horrible crime: murder, rape, arson, torture, and burglary for good measure in a house break-in in Connecticut carried out by two career criminals. We hate them as individuals by the time the description is concluded, and yet you argue they had no free will. So how do you punish people like that after such heinous acts?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. Clearly, we need to lock dangerous people up to keep ourselves safe, and that is... It's easy to justify that. I mean, everyone is better off keeping psychopaths off the streets. But the move that doesn't make sense is the retributive one, which says they deserve it in some deep sense. That, I mean, we might even want to punish people if, in fact, punishment were an important part of deterrence, or either the certain kinds of punishments for certain crimes actually changed people's behavior. That would be a pragmatic argument for the use of punishment, but it wouldn't be a retributive one. And so one analogy: if you imagine, you know, a grizzly bear gets loose in, breaks out of the zoo and starts killing people, we would still have to, bring in the police to shoot the bear, or at the very least capture the bear. We would want to separate ourselves from the bear. But at no point in this process would we think this bear really deserves this, or that it's right to hate the bear. We can fear the bear, but hatred doesn't make much sense once you recognize a bear as a bear.
And you want to see human beings with our developed brains in the same moral context as bears?
Well, it's not the same moral context in the sense that we have many more capacities that we desire and can expect from one another. We have compassion. We have ability to self-regulate. We can defer pleasure. We can value one goal higher than another, long-term goals over short-term goals. So nothing in my argument discounts any of that, or discounts the difference between the self-regulation of an adult and that of a child, the difference between voluntary and involuntary action. That is still something we can think about without invoking a spurious notion of free will. So it doesn't nullify the difference between ourselves and bears, or between sane people and insane people. But what it does do is, ironically, it undercuts hatred and increases compassion, for one thing. I mean, so if you want to be like Jesus, ironically, the one way into that is to think more clearly about, in a scientific sense, about the actual causes of human behavior. Take the worst person you could possibly think of. Take, Saddam Hussein. As a fully formed adult, he seems just a purely odious person. But if you just walk back the timeline of his life and realize that as a four-year-old boy, he might have been a strange boy, but as a four-year-old boy, he was a very unlucky boy. You have to be unlucky in this world to be born with the brains and genes and the life experience that is going to make you into a psychopath. And if we could have intervened in his life course at any point, we should have, and compassion would have been the right motive to intervene. So at what point does he become a purely an object of hate and no longer a fit object of compassion? I'm not discounting the fact that he was always an object of fear, and I'm not even discounting the fact that it was good to kill him. I mean, I think, in that case, I think we should have just kept him in jail. But clearly, we had to nullify his actions in the world. But hating him makes absolutely no sense if you realize that no one makes themselves, no one picks their parents, no one picks the time in which they were born, And even if you believe in a soul, and you don't believe that the brain is really the basis of the mind, you still have this problem of responsibility. No one picks their soul. No one. You have to be unlucky to have the soul of a psychopath.
So, do you then make a policy argument flowing from this argument against the existence of free will, that the best policy is early intervention to affect people's luck as much as we can, as early as we can?
Yeah. So, another point of possible confusion is that none of this suggests that effort and willpower and discipline and all of the things we do to change our lives deliberately are not actual factors. I mean, so you can be coached to be better than you're tending to be. I mean, all of these good conversations influence us. Reading good books influences you. Getting an education, all of this, all of your efforts matter. You can't get out of the stream of making efforts and choices in life. And a decision to do nothing for yourself or for anyone else is also a decision that has consequences and very likely negative ones. So it's all the efforts we make to change the world still matter, but losing this notion of free will allows us to focus on things that actually matter. Actually understanding the risk that a person poses to society, looking at the possibilities of deterrence and rehabilitation, with clear eyes. And I mean, we have 13-year-olds in this country who are serving life sentences, not because someone has really understood that that person, given his brain and life experience, can't be rehabilitated, but because some judge or jury thinks that person is the true locus, the true source of his thoughts and actions, and deserves to be punished in this way, in a retributive sense, not in a sense that it's just the prudent thing to do to keep him locked up, which in certain cases it might be. But again, to differentiate those cases would be to lose this notion of free will and just talk about what certain minds are likely to produce in this world.
Let's take a call from Dan in Brooklyn. Hi, Dan. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The issue that I wanted to raise was right off the bat, the guest kind of claimed that science gives us a deterministic worldview, and this is a kind of view that mirrors like all science writing today, but it's just objectively wrong. You know, physics, which is the science of science, has given us a non-deterministic worldview, and that's been the case for the better part of a century.
Right. Well, the idea that indeterminism, I mean, 2 points there. One is that the caller is referring to quantum mechanics and the indeterministic picture that it gives us. First, indeterminism doesn't get you any closer to free will. Indeterminism is just an introduction of randomness into the clockwork, so that it's like, you know, the difference between it, being a clock or being a clock that occasionally rolls dice. Now, the rolling of dice doesn't get you the free will people think they have. It just gets you some randomness, and random events are precisely those events for which we can take no responsibility. So as a path to free will, that is a dead end. The other point is that most neuroscientists believe that quantum mechanical events are really not operative or explanatorily useful at the level of the brain. I mean, there's some caveats there, but generally speaking, the brain can be thought of as a classical system and a largely deterministic one. So that randomness, if it is contributing to our experience and our perception and our thoughts and intentions, which no doubt it is, its contributions are generally not. We don't need to emphasize them in order to explain ourselves in scientific terms.
You know, we've been talking a lot on this show about the book The End of War by John Horgan. And I know you and he have had some back and forth in print, and he references you in this book. And around, on the same page, he references his dismay because he believes in free will. He takes a chapter of it to argue that there is free will. And he says he's dismayed not only by your position, but that your position is shared by Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of the double helix,
right,
who spent the last decades of his life studying the brain. And he says when he had a conversation with us about Crick, Crick pointed to the 1980s experiments carried out by the psychologist Benjamin Libe. I think you're right about him, too.
Yeah.
With subjects pushing a button at the moment of their choosing while noting the time of their decision, and that somehow that experiment produced the idea that subjects really weren't choosing when they thought they were choosing. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, these experiments have been very influential and to the dismay of some and to the satisfaction of others. Benjamin Libe was a physiologist who hooked people up to an EEG machine and gave them a very simple task to just decide to move their left hand or their right hand, you know, whenever they wanted. And they also just had to watch a clock while they were making this decision and notice what time it was. It was a specially designed clock. Notice what time it was when they were finally committed to moving left or right. And so they did this over and over again, and he measured the electrical potential of their scalp and discovered that nearly half a second before they were aware of what they were going to do, which is move left versus move right, or vice versa, he could tell what they were going to do. And this basic paradigm has been replicated now with other more sophisticated techniques of neuroimaging, fMRI, and even direct recordings from the cortex in surgical patients. And it is just uncontroversial to say now that some moments before you consciously are aware of what you will next intend, even in the simplest, the most basic voluntary motor action, your brain has already begun to form a motor plan, mm-hmm. and you become gradually conscious of it in the process of thinking that you are still free to decide which way you're going to go.
Your brain has already made the decision.
Your brain has decided, and it seems to me that people can't. If you look closely at this, you have to admit that you can't really take credit for your unconscious mental life.
But Horgan argues that Libet's clock experiment is a lousy probe of free will, because the subject has made the decision in advance to push the button. The only question is the timing.
Well, that's just in Horgan's defense. I haven't read his chapter on this, but that is just a silly argument, because this reaches back into everything we think and do and decide. There's no place where you can say the buck stops here. The buck just never stops. It's always preceded by unconscious neurophysiological events of which you are unaware and cannot control, and about which you become one of the last to know in the system. Now, that's not to say that decisions, again, decisions matter, efforts matter. You can do what you want, but your wants themselves emerge out of a wilderness of prior causes which you can't inspect and did not bring into being. I mean, you did not make yourself. You did not make your brain. You did not pick your parents. You did not. Every moment in which you seem to make yourself, where you make efforts and you learn new skills, the only tools at your disposal are those which you've inherited from moments past. And again, this, you could just say, so what? I still have to get out of bed in the morning and live my life, which is true, but there are certain things about our morality and about our legal mm-hmm. system, about our sense of public what is right to do to create a just society, that do shift when you take this view on board.
Sam Harris, author of Free Will, arguing that it's an illusion. Joe in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay, thanks.
I'd like to ask Mr. Harris about, there is a duality that exists in the world. In a religious sense, we're taught that we have free will to do right or wrong, good or evil. And in the real sense, in this world, the way it's composed or made up, our options and choices are very limited. So it's not like we have unbridled freedom. How do we equalize this in our own thinking?
Well, I think this it really does pull the keystone out of the religious notion of free will and all the work that does to make sense of morality, the morality of God. I mean, that is, when you ask religious people about the problem of evil, how could a good God let the Nazis just kill millions of innocent people? The argument you get back is, for the most part, free will. God gave us free will, and he couldn't stop the Nazis from sinning, essentially. Now, obviously, that doesn't cover all the other bad things that happen, like tsunamis and epidemics and things that have nothing to do with human agency and for which we could still hold God morally responsible. But religious people tend to think that free will gets God off the hook for many instances of evil. But free will, again, makes no sense. No psychopath is responsible for his soul, and he is very unlucky to be damned in that way and to be going to hell based on his behavior, based on his unbelief. I mean, I did not create my unbelief. I can't be solely responsible for my unbelief. I can't be responsible for all the intellectual influences that made it impossible for me to believe that Jesus was born of a virgin, for instance. And if I'm going to go to hell as a result of that, there's no way to make that seem just, because I was created in just such a way as to be closed to revelation, and that's not my fault. No matter how the this really is a culture war issue. I think much more than the issue of evolution, because this goes right to the heart of what most religious people, at least Abrahamic religious people, believe justifies the whole very notion of God's justice and then the concept of sin.
We're just about out of time, but let's end on this point, because you're known best prior to this book as a major critic of religion and somebody who tries to debunk myths associated with religion. But doesn't religion kind of cut both ways? It seems to accept free will because morality is emphasized and wrong choices can land you in hell in some religions, as you've been describing. But then religion is deterministic because it says God is all-powerful and controls everything. So how do we understand those two strands, how they fit together?
Yeah, well, they don't fit together. I mean, it is an incoherent view that free will does not make sense. Free will in the sense of being ultimately the source, or the ultimate author of one's thoughts and actions, and therefore fully culpable in the eyes of God, does not make sense with a notion of God seeing and knowing all things and being able to produce anything. I mean, it's just that this is the problem of one piece of the problem of evil, and there is no satisfactory answer for it, and that has been a problem for religion for at least 3,000 years. And it's a problem for the rest of us, because this notion of sin does intrude into our notions of public policy and the political difference between left and right, for instance. I mean, the liberals are far more in touch with the fact that even the most self-made person has benefited from the rest of society and did not create himself, did not create his genes or the infrastructure that has allowed him to succeed. And
so let me tack on one more question, because we mentioned John Horgan and the end of war, and we're asking a lot of prominent people on the show. We've asked Jimmy Carter and William Crystal and a whole bunch of other people about Horgan's theory. None of them read the book, that human beings could make war culturally unacceptable around the world, basically put an end to war over time, much as slavery has gone from legitimate institution to illegitimate one, or human sacrifice has. Do you think, in the context of your thinking on free will, that humans could ever abolish war?
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, our violent tendencies are obviously difficult to rein in, but I think, you know, the reality of war is, or the endurance of war is a result of the fact that we do not have a regime of international law that is really enforceable. And so, you know, civil war in most of the developed world is almost unthinkable. I mean, the idea that Vermont is ever going to go to war against Maine, you know, just for the fun of it, or because the locals get...
They don't share a border, but we'll skip that.
No. It even makes it less likely. But I'm just saying, just imagine California attacking New York for whatever reason.
Yes.
There'd be a problem of crime that we would solve as a nation, but there wouldn't be a problem of war to be solved. And if we had an international regime of whatever sort that could deal with the grievances among nations or deal with failed states. I mean, if there were someone like Kim Jong-il holding 25 million hostages in Florida, it would be a hostage crisis that we would solve as a nation, but it wouldn't be a war against North Korea. And so that would be, you know, so we need a world that can deal with hostage crises in the form of failed states and border disputes.
Vermont might wind up at war with New Hampshire someday, but that's another show.
Right.
Free Will is the new book by Sam Harris, thinker, writer, neuroscientist. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Brian.